Okay, we're up to the last part of Sefer Bereishit. The reason I call it the last part is that we essentially have before the Avod and after the Avod. So I don't know if you like that distinction, but I do. So anybody who's before the Avod is the first part of Bereishit, and that's all of them. And then you have the Avod Imahod, which of course you can tell me, but they're still around. Yaakov is still alive. Yaakov, right, is around throughout the parsha, but he's no longer the main character. Yet Yaakov is a side character. So you also could have told me that last week, you know, the children, the banim, are the ones who become, they're not the main characters last week. Last week, Yaakov is still the main character, although we hear of the children of Yaakov becoming more noticeable, but not noticeable enough. Okay, let's start, and I want to try to identify a couple of themes which sometimes we miss. And when I say sometimes we miss, it means that you all missed it. It's not there. The parsha noticeably begins Vayeshev Yaakov Eretz Megurei Aviv, and people say all kinds of drushot and Vayeshev. What does Vayeshev mean? Because Yaakov Shev Bishalva, and so on and so forth, and which were all very nice. And if you want, I'll tell you what Rav Soloveitchik said about that. But if you go back to last week's parsha, you actually have a parallel which is very important. The parallel begins when, well, it begins with the Eilatoldos Esav who Edom. So you have Eilatoldos Esav who Edom, and then you have Eilatoldos Yaakov, and how that continues will be a problem. Now, you all realize why it's perfectly fair to make a parallel between Yaakov and Esav? That would make a great deal of sense? Yes. Good. But the Esav Toldos makes a lot more sense than the Yaakov does. Because Yaakov is, Eilat told us Yaakov, Yosef. What happened to everybody else? By Esav, it's Esav l'kach, Eilat told us Esav who Edom, and then it talks about his wives and his children and so on. But what's interesting, it says, Esav l'kach noshev mi benos Kanan, and it starts giving you all the names which we will not go into. Pasuk vav, yikach Esav es noshev es bonov es benosov es kol mefoshos besov es mekneo es kol, and so on and so forth. Asher rachash be'eretz Kanan, v'yelech al eretz b'nei Yaakov achiv. That Esav left because of Yaakov. Now, I'm just going to say this quickly and parenthetically. I think that's remarkable, that Esav leaves because Yaakov is here. The Chumash continues and says, ki aruch l'shom rav mishevet yachtov, v'lo yichla eretz mugurim l'seid otam b'nei mekneim. So, but the only problem with this is, Esav already left before. When Yaakov comes back to Eretz Yisrael, he sends a message to Esav, who's where? By Seir, and then he goes back to Seir. Esav has already left, which means that Esav accepts, again, talk about Esav's kivud av, Esav has accepted that Yitzchak Avinu gave Eretz Yisrael to Yaakov, and he picks up and he leaves. That's it, he goes. The Chumash then continues, and it says, again, Ve'ela told us Esav, Avi Edom Bahar Seir. Ela Shomos Ben Esav, and gives us a whole list of all of the people. By the way, it's interesting, because here we find Eliphaz, and Eliphaz had, he, right? You know who Eliphaz was? We have then Pelegish of Eliphaz, and her and his quote-unquote illegitimate child, the child who's outside of wedlock, and who's that? That's Amalek. So that's what I was thinking about before class, is that you have a parallel between Yaakov and between Esav. You then have a parallel between Eliphaz and between Yehuda, and then you have, right? Because Yehuda then has a child out of wedlock. And what's interesting is that Eliphaz's child out of wedlock, Amalek, is where all of our problems come from, and Yehuda's child out of wedlock is essentially the line of Mashiach. So that I thought was, yes? Okay. So you can just do anything you want with that. But I thought that was... it's unbelievable implications. But anyway, we shall return to that. But that's... Did it sound important or no?
It sounds important.
Okay. Because I just thought of it 10 minutes ago. So leave me alone. So... it then goes through not just all the children. It starts with the Alufim. Yes? I saw one translation of Aluf is a duke. The Dukes of Esav. I just thought that sounded good. And it talks about the kings as well. And when it talks about the kings, it makes a very interesting statement. This is getting almost the end of the parasha. And we don't realize it when we read this, that this is the most important pasuk in terms of our parasha. But as I said, we don't realize it. And then even after I say it, you're going to tell me you don't understand what I'm saying, which means not only don't realize it, even if I tell it to you, you won't understand it. And that is, Ve'ela ha-malachim, and these were the kings, Ashemochu be'eretz Edom, who ruled in the land of Edom, lefnei malach melech levnei Yisrael, before there was a king among the Jewish people. So it really does sound like a very unexceptional pasuk. And again, I'm going to say something that needs to be said. Whenever we get to the sections of he begot, and so on, those are the most boring things, and we skip them over because there's nothing interesting to get out of that. Correct? Correct. But there may just be some interesting things, like I just now pointed out with this Pilegish and this Timna, and eventually with Amalek coming from it. And this reference over here is another attempt to tell us that we should be making a contrast. Right? This was the strongest contrast that we've seen. We saw Esav goes to this land because of Yaakov. Again, that's the comparison or contrast. We see over here that there are kings in Edom before there are kings of Israel, which are telling us that there is a contrast. Now, keep all of that in mind, and now we're going to start all over again. Vayeshev Yaakov, well, we actually just now had a Vayeshev Esav. I don't know if you've noticed that. There was a Vayeshev Esav, now Vayeshev Yaakov. Esav is sitting in Seir, and Yaakov is sitting in... Okay, good. Now, we're going to start with Pasuk Beis and ignore everything else beforehand. Ela told us Yaakov Yosef. Now that's strange, because it should have said Ela told us Yaakov, and he had four wives and a bunch of kids and so on and so forth. So why only Yosef? Question number one. The rest of the Pasuk is quite difficult. It says, Ela told us Yaakov Yosef, Ben Shvasrei Shana Haya, Roa es Echav Batzon, V'hu Naris B'nei Bilov B'nei Zilpa B'nei She Aviv, V'yivei Yosef Ediba Samra El Avihim. How's that for a run-on sentence? That was one pasuk. And that one pasuk needs to be broken down and to be understood what it says. What did you find the most remarkable part of that pasuk? Okay, you didn't find anything remarkable. Yes. What about them? Okay, so that's very good, but you missed the main part.
He was shepherding the brothers.
He was shepherding the brothers, and he's not a shepherd, which is interesting. Okay, he's shepherding the brothers. Which brothers? So it seems to be shepherding the children of Bilhah and Zilpah. But do you notice how it referred to Bilhah and Zilpah? That was the main thing. There's always like one little word, Neshe Aviv. Who perhaps did not necessarily agree? And how do you know? Prove it. What? Prove it. That's the Medrash. Prove it. I don't mean it. I'm not against Midrashim. I like Midrashim. But if you can show me where the Pasuk actually said it, I'd be far more impressed.
Is it only told with them, not
what?
Is it only with them, not really?
Can you show me where the Pasuk actually says it? Okay. Yosef, it says, black and white, Uhu na'ar et b'nei bilhav b'nei zilpa neshe aviv. By the way, how do you want me to read it? The Ashkenazi Sfaradi, can you tell me how I'm supposed to read this?
Sorry.
He reads the, he it says that where is he? Uhu na'ar et b'nei bilhav b'nei zilpa neshe aviv. The main word is neshe aviv. Who did not agree that Bilhah and Zilpa were neshe aviv?
What?
How do you know? He didn't move the bed, so stop it. I know. Kol Misha Omer Reuven Chata Ein Ela Toa. So you're not allowed to say it, but that doesn't mean he didn't do it, right? Yes or no? But why is that relevant about him moving the bed? That sounds like a euphemism. Okay, I'm not even going there. I'm not going there.
It shows that he got his mother's
marriage. No, what did the Pasuk say? Tell me what the Pasuk said.
This one?
No, I know what this one. I just read this four times. What did the Pasuk say about Reuven? With who?
Pilegish
Aviv.
Pilegish Aviv. 1 second. Did that strike anybody as important just now? Reuven gets in bed with Bilhah Pilegesh Aviv, and Yosef he herds over. A shepherd is somebody who takes care of. Yosef shepherds over B'nei Bilhah, B'nei Zilpah. What word did it use? Nishe Aviv. Now, one second. Is that a clear enough hint over here? Or I need to be much clearer for you? You can say it. Don't be embarrassed. That when it comes to Reuven, okay, you have to understand this more. Two possibilities. One is Reuven suddenly lusted after Bilhah, who's probably old enough to be his mother, right? Or there is some kind of a plan over here. So you know what the problem is? I keep trying to explain things to you and you don't listen. What is the context? The context is, who will be king? Trust me on this. The context is, who will be king? There's a king of Edom before there's a king of Israel. The kingship seems to be going together with who's going to be the firstborn, who's going to be control, who's going to be the most important son, right? Just go like this. It makes me happy. So go like this. So Reuven tries to stake his claim. By the way, later on Tanakh, we're going to find a very similar situation with somebody who tries to take his father's Pelegesh in order to prove that he's going to be the next king. Who's that?
Avshalom.
You have Avishag, who Adoniah asks, oh, by the way, Dad, can I borrow your Pelegesh, take her out for a spin? And what are you talking about? He's trying to make a claim to be king. Reuven, once you understand the later cases in Tanakh, you realize that's exactly what Reuven's doing. Reuven is, okay, again, think cynically, think in a Machiavellian way, think in terms of politics, think in terms of power. You have Yaakov, 4 wives, 10 children. You're Reuven. First thing you want to do is you want to get rid of as much competition as you can. How do you get rid of 4 of the pretenders in one sweep? You show that those are property of your father. Property, not children, not wives. What's one of the things, and you all know this sometimes in your head, what is it, the terrible thing that B'nai Leah said about the children of B'nai Bil and Zilpah? They called them Avadim. You get it? If they call them Avadim, then what do they consider their mother? Pilagshim, and not Nashim. So when you read this Pasuk, I know you can tell me the Medrash. I'm just telling you the Pasuk says it. You just have to know how to read the Pasuk and read between the lines. Reuven gets in bed with Bilhah, the Pilegish of his father, while Yosef takes care of the children of Bil and Zilpah, the wives of his father, which means Yosef is preaching equality among all the children, while the children of Leah, or at least one so far who we're going to pick on, Reuven, seems to be trying to claim that B'nai Bilhah and B'nai Zilpah are not children, those are not wives. He is therefore going to take this woman, show his ownership. He's the one who's going to inherit. This is his property. Just about his property anyway. But of course Yaakov doesn't necessarily agree. And then that's really where we're up to right now. But I keep telling you that the issue over here is kingship because of the whole comparison back in terms of Esav. So let's continue. By the way, what happens when Yosef shows his love and devotion and achva, v'ahava, v'ra'a, for the children of Bil and Zilpah? Do we now have one big happy family, or others going to be upset with him? Which means we're about to see something interesting, and what we're about to see is that what we already know, and how do we already know it? Because it was the pasuk before, that Yosef really is going to be the one who's the primary son, as far as Yaakov is concerned. Eila toldot Yaakov Yosef, just forgot about all the others, Eila toldot Yaakov Yosef. So when Yosef says, well, no, everybody's equal, so he, on the one hand, he's lifting up the children of Bil and Zilpah, but on the other hand, what's he doing? On the other hand, what's he doing? He's pushing down the children of Leah, creating equality when earlier I could have claimed, I have Yosef, right? 6, B'nai Leah, and then I have the 4 B'nai Bil and Zilpah. So they, I mean, each one had somebody under them, but Yosef then goes all the way down, lifts them up, gives them credibility, equality, but at the same time, it's a smack in the face of all the children of Leah. But again, is Yosef doing this out of cynicism, or is Yosef doing this really out of sense of brotherhood? I think he's doing this out of sense of brotherhood, but of course there's going to be some collateral damage to the love that he's showing towards the children of Bil and Zilpah. He doesn't put himself on top.
Of
course, that's part of why they hate him.
Right.
Who are you? Exactly. Oh, you're putting them there? Exactly. So that, now you understand some of the dynamics, and let's continue to the next pasuk. Next pasuk says, "V'yisrael ahavet Yosef mikol banav kiven zikunim hulo v'saluk turnuk pasim." Again, we have three elements in this pasuk. We have the part of love, we have the ben zikunim, and we have the turnuk pasim, and each part needs to be understood. Now, firstly, listen carefully to my question. Does Yaakov love Yosef more than his other children?
Yes.
Never said that.
Yaakov, Israel assumed that.
Should we try again? Go ahead, tell them how I fooled them on purpose in the question. Go ahead. It never says Yaakov, it says Israel. So let's try again. Is the shift between Yaakov and Israel a significant shift at this particular point?
Yes.
Because what is Yisrael versus what is Yaakov? So if Yaakov's personal and Yisrael's national, it doesn't say that Yaakov loves Yosef more than all the others. It says that Yisrael loves Yosef more than the others, which does not point necessarily to a personal emotional love as much as it points towards something, a sense of national leadership, because that the name of Yisrael was introduced over here. One second. Do we all agree now in retrospect that the name Yisrael may be significant at this particular point, especially we just now shifted from Yaakov right before, and we keep going back and forth over here. That's also something that you need to note. Ben Zakunim. What does Ben Zakunim mean? And you know if you're going to say the wrong thing, I'm going to give you a hard time, right? So what does Ben Zakunim mean? So if you're going to say it means his youngest son, right, as people use the terms, that's a little difficult because he has, A, he's got a couple of other children who are more or less the same age, and B, he's got another son who really is the Ben Zakunim, and that's Binyamin. So how could you say he loves him because of Ben Zakunim, which is why the Targum over here gives a different definition, and what does the Targum say? Ben Hakim. Zakain as an elder, as somebody who's wise, so he loves Yosef because of his capability, because of his brilliance. By the way, does that ring true, or I'm just like forcing in? There's two possibilities. One, he loves Yosef because he loved Rachel, and because he loved Rachel, he loves Yosef, and therefore everything else is just a cover-up. I mean, that's the truth. He just loves him because he loved her. Or is this, and by the way, I hope you all note, it never said that Yisrael loved Rachel. It said Yaakov loved Rachel. So Yaakov loves Rachel. So who loves Yosef? So let me point out again. Yaakov sees within Yosef capability. Does this strike you as strange? Yes or no? There's a quick yes or no. Every single person who meets Yosef sees those capabilities. Every single person who meets him sees it, except for one small group, and that small group are his brothers. He gets to Potiphar's house. Potiphar sees it immediately, puts him in charge of everything. Gets to prison, they see it immediately, puts him in charge of everything. Gets to Paro's house, they see it immediately, puts him in charge of everything. So Yaakov loves him, ki ben zakunimi. What is sinat chinam? Sinat chinam is what the brothers feel towards Yosef. They cannot see his capabilities. Everybody else can see it, they can't see it. More about that in 2 weeks. Now, ketonet pasim is mentioned only one other time in Tanakh. Giving him special clothing would take me in one of two directions. The first direction it would take me would be that it's sort of like the Big Day Kahuna, Big Day of Kohen Gadol. You have this as also a possible interpretation of Esav not wanting the Bechor. Later on we find out that the Bechor is the one who will serve in the Beit HaMikdash. If Yosef as a Bechor is the one who's chosen, and he was the real Bechor in the sense that Rachel was the one he really wanted, but he's a Bechor from his mother, so maybe that's what all of this is about, and therefore he gives him clothing of the Kohen Gadol, which I would say again is one possibility, but I don't like it as much as the second one. The second possibility is look for the only other time in Tanakh that not just Ketonet, because Ketonet is mentioned in context with the Kohen, but look when the only other time in Tanakh with Ketonet Pasim is mentioned, and Shmuel Beit, who's there? Rashi or Ramban, who took you there? What? So both Rashi and the Ramban both mention it. Rashi misses the significance. I don't know why. He just sort of said, you know, like in passing without talking about the significance and saying why this is important. The Ketonet Pasim in Shmuel, if you bother looking it up, is talking about, ironically, it's talking about not siblings who hate one another, But you get the irony. I mean, those of you who don't know the story, over here you have Amnon, who's a son of David HaMelech, who falls in love with his sister Tamar, his half-sister, and then he takes her and he rapes her. And the mention of Ketonet Pasim is that she rips it off, so you have the ripping of clothing over here, because after he has his way with her, he kicks her out, and now he hates her, he despises her, she's now a sign of his own weakness. So you have love and hate siblings. That's also interesting. Love and hate siblings. Of course, the great irony over here is that it's no longer Yosef's line, and now it's Yehuda's line, which there has to be like a little, and if you want, you can call this a little Mida Keneged Mida, or if you don't like those things, call it karma. But it is real interesting that now we've moved over to Yehuda's line, and we have, again, siblings not getting along with one another, and suddenly Ketonet Pasim coming there as the symbol of the cloth, not just symbol. And we're told in the Pasuk, black and white in Shmuel, that this is the clothing that royalty wears. I mean, that's what's black and white, and that's what Rashi should have gone one step further and say, oh, not just it's there. Rashi makes this terrible assumption that, don't worry, that all of you know Tanakh. So he says, oh, it's in Shmuel. And you're like, yeah, it's in Shmuel. So, but it actually says it's clothing of royalty. If that's the case, then this whole pasuk is very, very clear. Yisrael loves Yosef because he's so capable and gives him royal clothing. So, again, anybody think I'm forcing this into this so far, this whole theme or this sub-theme of kingship? Okay, if you can't, I mean, you can say yes if you want to. But you have the parallel with Esav before there was a king of Israel. You have over here Yisrael choosing him. But the best thing is what comes right next, so why should I bother working so hard? It says that the Vayiru Echav Ki Ahav Avihem, the brothers, by the way, make no distinction, Yaakov, Yisrael. They just see that Yosef is enjoying the love of their father. Vayisna'u oto, and they hate him. V'yelo yuchlu dabru l'shalom. V'yechalom Yosef chalom v'yaged le'achav. V'yosifu od sna oto. He has a dream. They hate him even more. V'yomer le'im shimuna chalom hazeh asher chalamti. V'nei anachno me'lim alumim v'toch hasadeh. V'nei kama alumatai v'gam nitzva. V'nei tesubena alumotechem v'teshtachben alumati. V'yomer lo echav. They say to him, hamloch timloch aleinu. One second. Is that good enough now? Or do I have to work any harder? Is it right there? Will you really be the king over us? And if not, they write, Mashol Timshol Banu. Who remembers the Gra? Kila Shehamlucha Moshe Bagoyim. That there's two types of leadership. There's one that we coronate, that we accept, and that's a melech. And another type, which is a Moshe, which is a ruler, whether we like it or not. Are you going to be the king? You think we're ever going to accept you? We're ever going to coronate you? I'm a Sholtum Sholbani. Do you ever think that you really have the capability to be our leader? By the way, what's the answer?
Yes.
The answer is yes. So, what are the problems that we now have? We have lots of intrigue. We have Reuven, right? Reuven, who considers some of the family not really family. We have Yosef, who considers everybody family. We have Yaakov, who favors Yosef. We have Yisrael, thank you, who favors Yosef. And we have Yosef now having dreams. The dreams, the best way I can explain them, is somehow connected with prophecy. What's also interesting is that one dream is about alumim, sheaves, the other one is about kochavim. You put the two of them together and you have Yaakov's dream of a ladder with its foot on the ground and up in the sky. Yes? You like that trick? I can do that again if you want. That there seems therefore to be a sense, even from Yaakov's perspective, aviv shamarta davav, that there is something there about Yosef's dreams which resonate. There is something which is really quite remarkable, which all of us miss, and it's okay, because everybody misses it. And I first saw this in Chamesh Drashot of Rav Soloveitchik, which when Rav Soloveitchik passed away, the Boston Rebbe, who's the father of today's Boston Rebbe, gave a hesped for him. There was one hesped in Meish Arm, where all the people who wouldn't come to YU or any of the other places, like all came, Rav Yechiel Michal Feinstein was there, and whatever. You know who that is? Okay, anyway. He's Rav Moshe's nephew, who was married into the Soloveitchik family. And the Rav opened up yeshiva in Boston before his father passed away. It was called Yeshiva Hechel Chaim Halevi. That was the name of the yeshiva. So the Rav was the Rosh Yeshiva, and Rav Yechiel Michal Feinstein, Rav Moshe's nephew, was the Rosh Kolel. He later was like, come to Israel, straight into the real Haredi world. But as I said, there is this family connection between the Feinsteins and the Soloveitchiks, and later on there's by marriage as well. There's a lot more to say about this. I'll stop. But the amusing thing that the Boston Rebbe said at the time was that the Rav once told him that all the speeches I gave to the Mizrahi, I could have given the same ones to the Aguda. And the fact that he told us over meant to me that he never read any of the speeches and he never heard them. Because if he did, he couldn't have said this. In the first speech, which is called Yosef Ve'achav, Yosef and his brothers, Rav Soloveitchik goes on, without ever using the term, he goes to war against Das Torah. And he makes the following statement. He goes, you know, you can think that because the vast majority of the Gedolim and Rosh Yeshivas and Hasidish Rebbeim in pre-war Europe all thought that we're staying in Europe and the future's in Europe, and then the very few, the dreamers, like Yosef, the dreamers believe that we can go someplace else, we're going to Eretz Yisrael. So he said that don't think for a second they weren't Tzaddikim and they weren't Talmid Chacham, and they were. He goes, but we had a machlokas. This is a machlokas between the dreamer Yosef and between the others. And then he said about something that I thought was remarkable because I thought it was such good pshat. He said, take a look about why they were couldn't even imagine Yosef's dreams. And what I'm going to tell you now, I'm going to take it to a couple more levels past what he said. But listen to what he said. What did the brothers do for a living at that point? They were shepherds. What's Yosef's dream about? His dream about farming. What's the difference between a shepherd versus a farmer? Which, by the way, goes back to, as kind of I'm saying, it goes back as early as you can. But what's the difference between a shepherd and a farmer? The difference is, are you connected to the land? Or you're not connected? Which means, you are a nomad. A shepherd is a nomad, goes from place to place to place. It's Bedouin. So the brothers are Bedouin. The brothers are not connected to land. The only way you can plant something is if it's your land and you plan on being there past one season. You can't plant something if you're not going to be around to cultivate, to harvest, and so on and so forth. Which means Yosef sees controlling land. By the way, if you go back now, Vayeshev Yaakov. It means Yosef is really seeing the vision of what Yaakov has, while all the brothers are just basically think tomorrow. What's going to be tomorrow is what is today. That's what the Rav accused the Gedolim in Europe. They said that we're in Europe today. We'll be in Europe tomorrow. We'll stay in Europe until Mashiach comes. So he said they imagine the future through the prism of the past, while Yosef saw the future, and he was a visionary, he was a dreamer, and he saw a different future. So he said, Kodesh Baruch Hu Paskin, like Yosef. That's what he said, Kodesh Baruch Hu Paskin, like Yosef. Kodesh Baruch Hu Paskin against the Gedolim. Kodesh Baruch Hu Paskin against... And he goes, Kodesh Baruch Hu is the ultimate arbiter in terms of Jewish history. You can have every sfar that you want, but Kodesh Baruch Hu Paskin's against? No, what are you going to do? So he used this as his springboard, but... And again, he's talking about politics in the 1920s, 1930s. But if you take a look at what he said in the Psukim here, again, I thought it was remarkable. But as you correctly pointed out, it does go then all the way back to Cain and Hevel, with another chilling connection that the brothers see themselves as Hevel, because Hevel was the shepherd, and they see Yosef as Cain. So they're the good guys, and Yosef is the bad guys. A matter of fact, when Yosef comes out to the field to see them, that's the field. It's the same place. Same thing. No words are exchanged, right? We don't know any words that were said with Yosef. They're all doing the talking about themselves, and they're ready to go and to kill him. They see him as being a Cain type of figure who's only, you know, bent on destruction, bent on doing terrible things, wants to control whatever. They see Cain as back there in their lives, as their brother, and they're a bunch of Hevels over here. So I'm just saying that this land versus shepherding distinction becomes real, real interesting. Yeah.
All the others pretty much were the shepherds. The saying goes, now that God is strong, now he should, no God told him to settle.
He sees the future. The future is Eretz, right? Zavad Chalav Udvash, and we need to grow grapes so we can have wine. Yes? Yeah.
Is there a connection between Yosef's dreams and
Parashat? Yes, yes. In a different book I wrote, I have an article there called Dreams, 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 which connects all the dreams together.
Good.
Yeah. But not here. Anyway. But yes, all the dreams are connected. And those are the themes that you need to look for. Because even the dream, what were Power's dreams about? What were Power's dreams about? Right. So you take, again, all the dreams that over here, you can chart them all, from Yaakov's all the way through. All the dreams, there's a theme which goes through them. Okay. Let's go back. Yosef has the second dream, the dream, right. Afterwards, what do we have next? Pasuk Yud Bet. Vayechu echav lerot et son avihim b'shchem. The brothers go to Shechem. By the way, if you're doing this like as a movie or something, you hear the word Shechem, you need a little music in the background. What kind of music? Yeah, Shechem's got to have like scary music there, because bad things always happen by Shechem. Vayomer Yisrael el Yosef. Did he notice anything? Vayomer Yisrael el Yosef. Lo achecha ro'im b'shechem l'chav eshlachecha aleihem. Vayomer lo hineni. Vayomer lo lechna re'e et shlom achecha v'et shlom atzon v'hashivenu davar. What's interesting about that, first of all, it's Yisrael again. Secondly, it's Eimech Chevron. I hope you know the Rashi over there. On top of all that, Yosef tells his father what the brothers are doing, and his father's happy with it. This is exactly what we saw in the beginning of the Parsha. And Yaakov, or Yisrael, if you will, is very, very happy with this relationship. The Eimech Chevron is what Rashi says. What? Chevron's on a hill. So what is Eimech Chevron? Something deep, deep in Chevron. What's deep in Chevron? Avraham Avinu. The Bris Bein HaBesarim, the Brit Bein HaBetarim, from deep within Chevron, that's where it was determined that the Jews are going to go off into exile, the slavery will begin. That means that this is the beginning. This is something national which is taking place, Yisrael. This is something national. The slavery is about to start. Next, Pasuk Tedvav. Vayimtzeeu ish vihini toa bisadeh vishaleo ish lemor matavakesh. So where is Yosef now? Yosef is in Shechem, because Shechem is where he was told to go. Only one problem, the brothers aren't there. He bumps into a man, and the Chazal tells us that this man is a malach. Where did Chazal get this from?
Ish,
very good. Ish. Now where did Chazal get this from? Later on, when Yosef admits that I am Yosef, what does he say? Don't be upset. He goes, because God sent me down here. Which means Yosef senses that the hand of God was here. Again, think about it. You start in Hebron, you end up by Shechem. Oh, by the way, incidentally, what are the significance of those two places? Which two tribes are those two places connected to? Yehuda and Yosef. You're supposed to think that's very good, by the way. Yehuda and Yosef, which are the two candidates for kingship. Malchut Yehuda, Malchut Yisrael. Yehuda and Yosef are connected to these two places, which means the locations over here are very significant. Again, in terms of this theme. Yosef goes to Shechem, he can't find his brothers. What should happen next? He looks, he wanders, he looks up, he looks down, he's not there. They're not there, so what does he do? He goes back home. End of the story. That's it. It ends. But instead, somebody sees him. What are you looking for? And the next pasuk is just, the truth is, it's really so painful. What does he say in pasuk tetzayin? And it's authentic, and he means it. Vayomer et achai anochi mivakesh. I want my brothers, and that continues the rest of his life. This is what Yosef wants. He only suffers through one problem: is that his brothers don't necessarily want him. Which means, when I said before that he wants all the brothers, he wants all his brothers. He wants them all to be equal. What can he do if his father favors him? Again, that's not really even a part of it. Yosef wants all of his brothers. He wants this friendship, this association. He takes responsibility for his brothers. But by the way, I don't know if you ever thought about it. Yosef was in charge of Egypt for roughly 80 years, which as far as I can tell is longer than anybody else in Tanakh in a leadership position like this. For the vast majority of the time, the brothers arrived when he was 39 years old. So from the time of 39 till 110, he gave them food, he gave them jobs, he gave them clothing, he gave them places, he gave them everything. Yosef took care of his brothers the rest of his life. Yosef wants his brothers. This, as I'm saying, is incredibly true. And that's the tragedy. That's the tragedy. Vayomer ha'ish nasu mizeh ki shamat om nechel datona. Anybody near where Daton is?
Jenin.
I said that last year? You know.
Yes.
It's Jenin. Okay, good. Jenin is a nice place also this time of year. Vayelech Yosef acher echa v'yimtzaim b'dotan. V'yir'u oto mirachok. How do they recognize him?
The coat.
The coat. Right. It's like a bullseye. Right. They see it from afar. And again, you realize now the irony. If he didn't have the coat, they wouldn't have recognized him afar. Only reason you recognize Yosef from afar is because he has the coat. V'yir'u oto mirachok. They see him from afar. V'yinaklu oto lahamito. And they begin to conspire in order to kill him. V'yimur ish el achiv. Okay, who's speaking to whom? Who's speaking to whom? How do you know? First of all, Rashi says it in the future. Rashi will say it by next week's parsha. when he takes Shimon and he puts him in prison, and he'll say that Shimon was the one responsible. Good. How does Rashi know it? Good. Excellent. So let's start with Reuven. It's not Reuven. How do we know it's not Reuven? Because Reuven's going to speak soon. It's not Yehuda, because Yehuda's going to say something else soon. So we start with Reuven, and we go down to Yehuda. We have two in the middle. But there's something else about these two. What do they say? These two. We're saying it's Shimon and Levi. They say, let's kill them. Shimon and Levi kill anybody near Shechem? Yes? Can we all now agree that this was Shimon and Levi? Once you start to solve your problems by killing your enemies, you can finish that sentence any way you want. You end up seeing killing people as a wonderful way of solving your problems. Right? To real or imagined enemies. So, my candidate over here is Shimon and Levi. Ish ve'achiv. Right? Right? What does it say in Vayechi? Shimon ve'achim. It's ish el achiv. This is Shimon Levi. Anything you say, I'm not going to agree with you, unless you can bring me like proof, but you can't. So, and I'll say another thing. What are B'nai Bilhah and B'nai Zilpah doing as this is going on? So this is far more interesting, because on the one hand, Yosef is their protector. On the other hand, bless you. On the other hand, now, again, I want you to get more cynical. I want you to, you know, channel your inner Machiavelli. I hope you know what that is. How do you play this? Is there a conflict? Yosef is their protector, but what's happening right now? It's their chance to become real brothers. How could they become real brothers if they're in on it? If they're in on it, then they suddenly become equal within this conspiracy. So suddenly, Bilhah and Zilpah's children are very, very quiet watching this take place, and they never say a thing, of course. They're the ones who are quiet on the side, but in their silence they acquiesce, and in their silence... Excuse me? In their silence they... Right, I said in their silence they acquiesce. Okay, you said it much better. In their silence they end up joining this conspiracy because, as I said, it became something very convenient because once they join... Now they have real brothers. Now they have equal standing. And now they can blackmail the others as well. And again, just start to think in terms of the real world. At that point, Reuven speaks up. And okay, the rest of the plan, Vayomi Ishel Achiv, right? Whole plan already. An animal did this to him. V'nirem ayuchal motav. V'ishma Reuven v'yitzileu miyadam. Which is also very strange. Why did Reuven suddenly get involved in this? So we have a whole bunch of reasons that we can give. Actually, we have a whole class on Reuven tomorrow. Vayitzileu miyadam, and he saves them. He saves them from them. We will not take a life. The Midrash, by the way, we don't have to go any further. The Midrash gives a whole bunch of reasons. One of them is, No, this is really 19th century. We'll find both the Rav Hirsch and the Malbim both say that that if anything happens to Yosef, remember, Reuven's plan was to get the B'nai Bilhah and Zilpah out of the way. His only other real competition is Yosef, so he has the most motive for doing anything. There's also a midrash that says that, remember, we're told that Yosef would tell the bad things that people did. He's the one who told his father what Reuven did with Bilhah. That's the Dibarah that he told. Dibarah that he told was what Reuven did, and therefore Reuven had even more motivation for doing it, which again takes us back to why he doesn't. Well, that's because he has the most motivation. And if you have the most reason, then you may not want to do this because you're going to get blamed. But he says, we're not going to kill him at all. There's one other beautiful medrash which says the exact opposite. It says that Reuven is thankful to Yosef because after he sinned, he ran the risk of being written out of the family. I mean, really, it is a profound sin. It's so profound, Chazal. Right? I'm going to say it again. Kol mi she'omer she'ruven chata ena ela toa. Right? So therefore, the Torah is wrong by saying it, and therefore Yaakov Avinu is wrong by saying it, and therefore a whole bunch of Tanoim are wrong by saying this, because it says it. I mean, what can I do? It actually says that he did it. So we hopefully now understand the motivation for it. By the way, you want pshat? I think the pshat is like this. There's no question that Reuven did it. Okay, you have to go like this. Now, there's no question that Reuven did it. But afterwards, Reuven does tshuva, which hopefully we'll have time to get to. Reuven does tshuva. Now, if Reuven does tshuva, so what happens? Are you allowed to tell about tshuva afterwards and talk about his chait? You can't talk about his chait afterwards. He did tshuva. right? But what if his chait still had ramifications? So just stop there for a second. Just stop. Just stop. Let me go back now to Reuven. Reuven says he's going to save him. The biggest question, Reuven, so why doesn't he save him? So save him. So like, meaning, what happened? So we'll hold on, and maybe we'll come back to the Rashi. Reuven says, absolutely not. Do not spill blood. And he want, and Leman Hetzilo told me Adam, Ulishiv Aviv, and take him back to his father. Vayika Sheba Yosef. So all this happened before he gets there. And when Yosef arrives, Vayika Sheba Yosef El Echov, Vayifshitu et Yosef et Ktunato, Ktunat Pasim, Asher Olive, they ripped the clothing off of him. Vaykachu, Vayashlichu, El To Habora, Vaborek, Ein Bomayim. And so on and so forth. So they decide not to kill him. Reuven throws him in. Reuven's argument, by the way, sounds that what his spoken argument is, killing is so messy. You know, Shimon and Levi, you know what the laundry bills were like afterwards, getting all the, according to the Medrash, there were 24,000 people they killed there. The Medrash says this is it's equal to the 24,000 people that were killed later on by Cosby and Zimri and all that. And because there's a whole in Indian of reincarnation, Cosby and Zimri with Shechem. Okay, we're not even going there. Okay. And it's connected to 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva as well. Right? No chesed, too much chesed. No chesed again. Okay. Tikkun. Okay. So it's messy to kill people. Just put him in the pit. He'll die of natural causes. That's his spoken plan. He'll die of natural causes. Reuven wants to save him, but as I said, that he doesn't ever do it, which leads us to the conclusion once again that Reuven never really does things that he's supposed to do. So, coming back then, they said, okay, now that he's in the pit, stripped off of his clothing, screaming. Yes, he was screaming? I didn't know he was screaming. Because later on, the Torah says he was screaming. We heard our brother's screams and we ignored him. Yes? It says it, so what can I do? It says it. I know the Rashbam claims they weren't even there. They were far away. They didn't know anything was going on. They didn't even see the sale. They did the sale. They saw the sale. They heard the screams. Yosef said you did it and all this. The Rashbam, I can explain the Rashbam, but I don't want to. I explained it last year? So I'll just explain it now. So the Rashbam, leave it. The brothers are sitting and eating. They're sitting and eating, having a nice meal, which is preposterous. Having a nice meal as your brother is screaming. I do believe, again, this is the beginning of going down to Egypt. The beginning of going down to Egypt is a family fractured, a family broken up, family screaming, and they're sitting and eating. When they come out of Egypt, before they can leave, they need to have a suda of the family sitting together in order to do a tikkun for this meal, and then they can leave. And that's the Pesach. That's the Pesach Seder, and that's why we invite people we don't want there. Okay, hope my wife's not listening. Okay, so then the miracle takes place. Yehuda has an einfalt. You know what an einfalt is? A brilliant idea. He looks up and he sees the Yishmaelim coming. He goes, hold it a second. This is crazy. Why in the world should we kill him? Right? That's written messy. Let's read the words, because the words are also somewhat preposterous. Until I say what I'm going to say, the words make no sense. You ready? Listen to what Yehuda says. Vayoma Yehuda el Echav, ma betza. Betza is like this. Ma betza ki narog et achinu. Casino at the mall. By the way, you suddenly hear a sound of brotherhood. What are we going to gain by killing our brother and covering up his blood? Let's sell him. Because he's our flesh and blood. They listen to him. What are you talking about? You should say, he's our flesh and blood. Let's bring him back to our father. He's our flesh and blood. Let's beat him up a little bit and tell him, stop acting the way that you act. And you're just one of us. You know better than any of us are. Again, we can give a lot of speeches and we can do a lot of things. What are you talking about? Let's not kill him. He's our brother. Let's sell him. He's our flesh and blood. So I've not seen any mucker that says this. But I think that this is pshat. When they look up and they see, when Yehuda looks up and he sees the Yishmaelim coming by, he says to himself, it's a sign from God. Because who's Yishmael? Yishmael is the son that got sent away. When Sarah sees Yishmael, she says, no, this kid cannot stay with my kid Yitzchak, he gets sent away. He sees Yishmael, Yishmael's flesh and blood of Yitzchak, flesh and blood of Avraham, who gets sent away, he sees Yishmael, this is a sign from God, what's he supposed to do? He's supposed to get rid of him. Right then, another group come by, Midian, and who's Midian?
No?
B'nai Keturah. Who's B'nai Keturah's? Who is Midian's father? Avram Avinu. And what does it say about Midian? It says that Kol B'nai HaPlag Shem Avram Natan Matanot, and he sent them away from Yitzchak, which means these are the people that get sent away while the Yitzchak family remains pure. Again, if you're Yehuda, these are two signs from God coming from two places. Suddenly Yishmael shows up, suddenly Midian shows up. This is the solution. This is our flesh and blood. We don't have to kill him. Just get rid of him. You're not even excited by that? He wants to convince all of them. He wants to convince, let's make some money off of all this. I don't know. I don't know how much money someone like Yosef could bring. You know, right now on the table, the plan was, the spoken plan was to kill him. Kill him actively, kill him passively. So Yehuda says, let's not kill him, let's just get rid of him. This is the ethical thing to do. No, I'm just saying, how is it the ethical thing compared to the last two things on the table? At that point, Reuven comes back. You want to ask something? No?
Yeah.
So now let's go back to Reuven now. At that point, Reuven comes back, and it says, Vayashav Reuven el Habor, v'nei ein Yosef Babor, v'yikra'et Bagadav. He's not there, and he tears his clothing. It's sincere. Vayashav elacha vayomar. Hayelad einenu v'ani ananiva. No, he's not here. What's going on? Where was Reuven? So Rashi over here, actually, in the Midrash, I found three interpretations. Rashi only brings two of them. Third one, if you remind me, I'll tell you, because I think it's very interesting. What does Rashi say? The first interpretation, Rashi says, that at that moment it was his turn to serve Yaakov, which is completely preposterous. I apologize to Rashi. The Medrash says it, so I understand. If he's going to serve his father that day, so let's get get the timeline down over here. The brothers sit down to food, and Reuven go running back to Chevron. By the way, if he had a car, there would not be enough time to do this. He runs back to Chevron, gives his father his lunch, comes back, and looks to see what his brothers are doing. And, oh, he's gone. The brothers put him in the pit, they sit down to eat, and then this whole thing plays out, and Reuven comes back. So where was Reuven? To say that it was his turn to go back to his father, wonderful. Maybe he should have taken someone else with him when he went back to his father. That was his own intention in the first place. It's his turn to go back to his father, so what does he do? He pulls Yosef out of the pit, and he brings him back to his father. The whole story's over. So where's Reuven? So Rashi, that's Rashi's first interpretation. How do I know that Rashi really doesn't love this interpretation either? Because he gives, only one more, he gives a second interpretation. What's his second interpretation? His second interpretation is that Reuven was involved b'sako v'ta'anito. That Reuven was involved in praying and fasting and praying at that time. Now, first of all, if he's fasting right now, why does he have to say he's fasting? That's why he's not eating with them. I'm just explaining that's where that comes from. He's fasting, that means that he's not eating with them, so they're all sitting to eat and he's someplace else and he's praying. But why is he praying right now? So again, this is something which I heard from Rav Soloveitchik, which I think may actually be, I saw Beis Halevi this year, which may actually say it, but he doesn't say it as clearly. But if you look, maybe it really is there. That Reuven listens to this plot unfold. Shimon and Levi, let's kill him, whatever. You know, again, they're tough and they're ready to go and kill people. And he's listening, he's saying, how in the world do they have such chutzpah? Or that I can say. Such chutzpah. How in the world can these people do something against the father? Think a second. Esav says, I'm going to kill Yaakov after our father is dead. And these people, no respect for the father? So you hate your brother, but no respect for your father? How can they, where is this coming from? And then it suddenly hits him. He was the first person who disrespected his father. And there's what we can call trickle-down morality. After Reuven, for some of you, I'll make you happy now, moved the bed and got involved in his father's life, deciding where and with whom his father will be sleeping, that once Reuven does this unbelievable act of chutzpah, So the brothers learn from this as well. The old man, who has to respect the old man, he doesn't know so much is going on. We're the ones who decide what's happening. And Reuven realizes that if it weren't for him, none of this would have happened. Of course, I'll say it a little differently. When Reuven realizes the fact that he got into bed with his father's either wife or Pelegish, and he can do such a sin, so now it's a moral free-for-all. Anybody can do whatever they want to do. And at that moment, Reuven breaks down, and he starts to cry, and he does tshuva for what? At that moment, it does tshuva for having gotten in the bed with... And that's the reason, kola omer, Reuven called to Ein Latoya, because at that point, he did tshuva. You're not supposed to remind about tshuva of what he did. But on the other hand, the ramifications of his actions are still there. How the ramifications are still there? Because the brothers still learned from what Reuven did, and how much did they learn from it? They were willing to sell Yosef. Either willing to kill him and willing to sell him. And we still suffer from Mechirat Yosef. The Rambam says that, by the way. We still suffer from Mechirat Yosef. The Rambam says that on every single holiday when family is supposed to come together, the Korban Chatat, which is brought, is always a goat representing the blood which the coat was dipped into. And he says, because we still need Kapara for the Sinat Chinam, which was then and is still today. And you have the Midrashim about Aseret Yemalchut and so on and so forth, which means we're still suffering from this. If that's the case, Reuven, sin doesn't disappear. If you want, it gets turned into a shogeg. It gets downgraded. He goes on to his father's bed instead of really the Maasev Nud. And I think that that's what the Gemara means over here, rather than say he never did it. I think the same thing is true with David HaMelech. Kol Mishom HaDavid Chote Ein Ela Toya. Okay, so David's wrong. Chatati Lashem. So David's wrong. So again, how can somebody say that? It's because in retrospect, after somebody did tshuva, so then how can you really say such a thing? And I know all the fanciful footwork which is taken in order to defend that a sin really didn't take place. Again, Malchut Beit David, and so on and so forth. But I think that that's much closer to Pshat. So Reuven at this point is absolutely devastated. Reuven realizes, and that's why he wants to save and bring him back. And now he realizes how far his sin has taken, and this whole family is now crumbling and falling apart. The third pshat in the Medrash, which now after you heard the other two, you say this one is maybe best. The third pshat is he went to look for a rope. Because he's in a pit. How do you get him out of the pit? He went around looking for a rope, and he comes. What? I don't know. One second. You don't like Midrashim that makes sense? You'd rather. I found this in the Psikta Zutra. It says, "V'yoshev Reuven el abor heichan haya Reuven Lezer Omer asukhu b'sakov v'tanito kevin shenifneh halach v'hitzitz." When he finished, then he went to look what's going on. V'yesha omrim halach lavi chevel la'aloto. He went to get a rope. What? It's not pshat.
It's pshat.
He went to look for rope. I saw all other commentaries looking and planning, and they went east, and he went west, and they went north, he went south, and he's trying to go around, he's trying to do an end around that no one's going to see him, he's sneaking under the trees or whatever, he's trying to get there, he doesn't want anybody to notice. He needed a rope. So that was the pshat. So what happens, how are we going to end this for today then? We're going to end this that we're leaving Yosef. Yosef is on the way to Egypt. Of course, you know the irony. You try to sell your brother as a slave, you end up as a slave. So that goes back to our karma, or midat keneged midah. They thought they got rid of him. They have not. I don't want to ruin the story for you, but they have not seen the last of him. I'm not going to tell you who he is because, again, I don't want to totally ruin this. But again, just to understand what happened, I don't think you understand any of this without understanding the dynamic. And I'm going to say it again. The main issue is still going to be all the way through who's going to be king. But it's not just, now we realize it's not just who's going to be king. It really becomes also a struggle, not just between the king of Melech Yisrael, or Melech coming from Yosef, and the Melech of Yehuda, or Melech ben David. It's really the issue is going to be Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David, which is really what's underneath all of this. And that's what's going to be played out in the whole last part of Reishit. It's going to get a lot closer, it's going to get a lot more personal. And the question is, as we move on, right now Yosef is the victim. At some point it's going to turn around, and then we have to then decide what is Yosef doing, what's his plan, and how and what's he trying to accomplish, and that we're going to have to come back to in 2 weeks.